This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Nicholas Pileggi, a journalist who specializes in writing about crime. He had a great shot at getting an insider's view of the mafia when he was offered the chance to write the life story of Henry Hill, a middle echelon career mobster. Hill had been in the Brooklyn branch of the Lucchese crime family since he was 11, when he was running errands for the neighborhood mobsters. He went on to organize a multitude of heists, hijackings, scams, and drug deals. He was also involved with some pretty well-known jobs. Hill worked on the $5 million Lufthansa heist, which was the most successful cash robbery in American history. And he masterminded the Boston College point-shaving scheme. Henry Hill initiated the book idea after he and his family joined the Justice Department's Federal Witness Protection Program. The program was Hill's only crack at freedom. The feds wanted him, and the mob was out to kill him because he knew too much. The Witness Protection Program gave Hill and his family new identities in return for Hill's testimony against his fellow mobsters. Hill hoped book royalties would help pay his considerable lawyer's fees. For Pileggi, Hill was the perfect source for the day-to-day details of mafia life. Pileggi's best-selling book is titled Wise Guy, Life in a Mafia Family. Wise Guy is the name Hill and his buddies used to call each other. They didn't call each other racketeers. Pileggi has been a contributing editor of New York Magazine since it was first published in 1968. I asked Nicholas Pileggi what Henry Hill's rank was in the mafia.
Well, he was not a big shot. He was a middle-level hustler. He was one of the guys in an organized crime group who was... They have different jobs. His job was to hustle money. He was what they call an earner. And so he was working on 3, 4, 6 dozen things at the same time. He would have a loan shark operation going. He was doing bookmaking. He had a phony restaurant. He was running guns. The end of his life, he was in heroin and cocaine. He was planning hijackings. He was doing hijackings. He was also divvying up the money in different situations, all at the same time, and flying up to Boston every couple of weeks to be able to fix and bribe Boston College ballplayers in a point-shaving scam. He never stopped.
One of the ways that he really came into his own as far as his work and crime was when he got into the Army. You talk about all the little schemes he organized when he was in the Army selling things.
Yeah. Well, he's Sergeant Bilko. That's who he is. And he said, I couldn't believe it. He said, you know what they do in the Army? He said, they buy the same amount of meat and cook the same amount of steaks, say, on the weekends that they do in the week, during the week. Only on the weekends, you maybe have 10 soldiers in a camp instead of 250. Because everybody's on weekend furlough. And he said, and there were all these steaks. They would cook them and throw them out. Cook them every weekend and throw them out. And he said, that was crazy. So what I did, he said, he stole all the steaks on the weekends and sold them to the local restaurants. He gave the chef or whoever was in charge of the kitchen a few bucks, and he pocketed the rest. Now that he's got some money, he realized soldiers are always broke. Come payday, they need money. So he would lend them 6 for 5. He had a little loan sharking operation going on. And he said it was wonderful because I'd stand at the end of the pay line on payday, and as they came down the line, they'd pay me back the money. And so he was absolutely doing very well in the Army from the wise guy's point of view.
With that experience, he came home, and when he got home, he started doing the kind of operations that we all vaguely know about, but we don't really know how they work. Like, we know that there's all these truck heists and hot goods that are sold, whether it's televisions or are now audio cassettes.
Yeah.
But... I mean, who knows how they're really done? He did it. So you found out how these truck heists are organized.
Yeah, well, it was fascinating. I mean, it was just a revelation to me. I had no idea how it... I mean, we all know about hijackings, but I had no idea they were hijackings to order, number one. And number two, there's a whole scale of things that you prefer to hijack. I would think, for instance, what would you... If you had your chance of hijacking a truck, what would you do? Well, somebody would say, well, I'd just hijack a truck full of $15,000 Rolex watches or something. You know, that's something really expensive. That's not it at all. Henry said the most valuable thing in the world to hijack is a trailer truck full of lobster and shrimp. I said, what? And he said, absolutely. He said, they go like that. And he said, we have all these restaurants. We know these guys. Now we're talking about legitimate, ostensibly legitimate restaurant owners in New York City, in the New York City area, who will buy a trailer truck full of lobster and shrimp so quickly. And he said, they just buy the truck. They'll buy a quarter of a truck. They buy an eighth of a truck, a tenth of a truck, half a truck, whatever they need. And he said, and by dinner, the evidence has been eaten. There's no evidence left. Everybody has been eaten. They just cooked it right then. The other thing they liked to steal were razor blades. They would steal these little packs of, you know, clip-on razor blades that people use. And the reason for their value is that they're so small and so expensive and so many and so easy to distribute, and no serial numbers, and they sell them off to ostensibly legitimate businessmen, guys who might have a little discount store here, guy who might have the whole little wholesale business that supplies lots of drugstores, and that's where they would unload this stuff. So one of the revelations I had was that they don't operate in a vacuum. They actually steal this stuff and then pass it on to ostensibly legitimate businessmen. They work in cahoots. The second thing that is fascinating is the way they knew what to steal. And it turns out they have friends and contacts and pals and people who owe them money, guys who are deeply in debt to gambling, guys who are deeply in debt to their bookmakers, have to serve as spotters. These are men who might work in an airport, they might work on the piers, they might work on the docks, they're in loading areas, they're in invoice areas, and they can spot the trucks. They can spot what's there. They tip the wise guys off, and they get a piece. They don't get a lot, but what they do is they can bring down their debt a little bit. It guarantees they're not going to get their kneecaps broken, and it's a way of surviving for them.
Now, some of the truck drivers are in on it, too, and they know they're going to be hijacked, and they play right along with it.
Absolutely.
How does that work?
Well, there's not much they can do. I mean, the truck driver knows that this truck, he's driving out of there with a truckload full of razor blades or shrimp or color televisions, and he's been given the signal. He knows that something's going to happen, and something does. He's along the road, and all of a sudden, two wise guys are there at a red light, and he just gets out. He knows. He gets out, and he gets into a tail car. They usually tail the truck to make sure there isn't a police car following, and he gets into the tail truck, and they'll take him to a motel. Quite often, they'll have some coffee. They'll take his wallet, and they'll take his license plate, his driver's license, and they'll know where he lives, and they'll know his name, and they'll say, if you remember what we look like, we know who you are, and we know you have a family, and you'll be sorry. And so when the police arrive, and they're not very cooperative. Well, I don't know. He'll say the guy was, he's 7 feet tall and he had green hair. I mean, they'll give a description that is totally opposite of what the men were. And they're safe. There's no way, the wise guys, that is, they're safe. They're gone. They've stolen the stuff. They've moved it into loading platforms and docks. That was the other thing. They have warehouses that are honest warehouses, not a mob warehouse with a mafia flag on the roof. It's a real warehouse where the truck next to it, the truck on either side of it, is unloading legitimate goods. But their truck, their little bay where they're unloading crooked goods, nobody knows. Things are not stamped. This load is crooked. These men are gangsters. But the guy who runs the crew, the hijacking gang, they know a guy who sort of maybe runs that warehouse or those loading platforms. And he gets a little bit too. So the money, the profits, are divided among legitimate people, quasi-legitimate people, who allow them to use their facilities to get these stolen goods into the mainstream of the American process.
Now, did the union play any part in this?
Yeah, at Kennedy Airport, one of the big complaints of the FBI and a lot of other people is that since a number of the locals out there are very heavily influenced by organized crime, when the airline says, wait a minute, every time this guy works, we lose a truck, a valuable truck. And last time we sent out two trucks, and we switch-swapped everything so that nobody would know unless he was really this guy, and it turns out he knew, and they stole the right truck. He is the spotter. We know he's the spotter. We're going to fire him. Well, if he is a member of a local that's organized crime, the organized crime shop steward, the guy who was working in that union, will go to the employer and say, you can't fire him. He's a union member. You can't prove it. You can't prove anything. If you fire him, we're going to have a wildcat strike. So the employers quite often have to hire them back, or they'll take them out of that area and put them someplace where they can't spot that well.
Was he during all this period aligned with a larger New York family?
Oh, yes. He was associated. His mentor was a man by the name of Paul Vario, who was a capo in the Lucchese crime family. Lucchese crime family is named after Thomas Lucchese, Three Finger Brown, one of the five large organized crime families in New York City. Major power on the waterfront, major power at the airport, major power in the garment center.
So what did he owe to the family? You know, he wasn't very big in the family, but he was a...
Well, he's a worker. I mean, that's who they are. They're all workers. There aren't a lot of bosses. They're just, everybody's a worker. And he was an earner, and he made a lot of money, and earned a lot of money for them. And he would pay tribute to his boss, who was Paul Vario. If he ever made a score... For instance, when they took $480,000 from Air France, when they stole $480,000, first thing he did was go and give $60,000 of it, $60,000 to Paul Vario. Paul didn't even know they were doing the robbery. He didn't have to know. Henry was out there hustling. You are on your own. It works quite differently than we sometimes, or than we have been led to believe by the movies and by often the FBI. They're really franchises. They're like franchisees. That's what it is. And only if they have a problem and a dispute among themselves do they take it to the next level. And then those men on the next level act as the judges in those disputes.
But if it turns out that he did a heist and didn't pay tribute, I guess that's when he'd really be in big trouble.
Then he's in trouble. And or if he decided to stick up a card game or just stick up a place that was associated with the families. Most of the murders, so many of the murders that he talked about in the book came about because young guys, tough young guys with guns, thought that they could go and stick up card games and stick up crap games that were run by organized crime families. And these young guys were often the sons of mob chiefs and mob bosses and mob lieutenants and capos. And the kid would go and do the robbery, and he would get away with it once, twice, three times. And the bosses would go and talk to his father. Will you stop your kid? He's going to get in trouble. We don't want to do things, but if he keeps this up, he's going to. And the fathers would go and talk to their sons and say, are you crazy? You can't do that. Go to another neighborhood. Stick up another card game. And the kids would go anyway. And eventually those kids were murdered. And when Henry talked about it, he says, if they liked the father, and they knew the family, they knew the father, they would always shoot the kid in the heart. I said, why? He said, that way his face was okay for the funeral.
Oh,
so they could have an open casket. I mean, that was a sign of respect for his father. They wouldn't shoot the man's son in the face.
Well, they seem to have such a very hard to understand for an outsider view of murder. For instance, after one of the really big jobs they did, and when they wanted to kill one of the people who knew about it and I think had worked on it, they said, yeah, but if we knock him off, then his wife is going to really pester us.
Yes. Well, he knew his wife.
Strange thing to say.
It's a guy by the name of Marty Krugman who had been the bookmaker and had been a little involved in this thing. And his wife was a smart woman. And she knew everybody. They, these people hang around together. They don't have any friends outside of their immediate world. And every crew, Henry's little crew with Jimmy and Marty and Anthony and all these guys, that's the crew. And their wives all hang around together. And if by some miracle they go to vacation somewhere, they all go together. It's like this little block of people because they can't trust anyone else. And they don't move outside of their little worlds. They're very parochial, very narrow. We're not talking about Al Pacino traveling to the Dominican Republic or to Brazil for the weekend with Kathleen Turner. I mean, we're talking about really working class, hard guys from a low income socioeconomic world, even though they make a lot of money.
He eventually got sentenced to 10 years in prison. But even in prison, he was able to do all this hustling. Before he even got into prison, he'd figured out ways of decreasing his sentence. What was his scheme for that?
Well, he had so many. But you see, that's it. A wise guy is a wise guy is a wise guy. They never stop. He was convicted of extortion and a whole bunch of wise guy stuff. And federal prison, got 10 years. I said, wow, 10 years. He seemed too young to have spent 10 years in a federal prison. And it turns out he spent about 4.5 of those 10 years in prison. Well, the first thing he tells you is, listen, if you're convicted on me, you get 6 days off a month for every six. And if you take this course and go to a continuation school, you get 3 weeks off every year of your sentence. And by the time he had figured all the schemes out, all the sincere rehabilitation programs that all of the penologists, all of the sociologists, all of the people studying this had worked so hard and industriously to get rammed through the legislature so that people in prison could rehabilitate themselves. Wise guys take those programs and distort them for their own purposes.
When he got to prison, there was actually a little welcoming committee there to meet him. What kind of inside connections did he have?
That's the other thing. If you're a wise guy, if crime is your life, and people who are in crime are your closest friends, you're also going to know everybody who's in prison. This is a continuing saga that goes on, and it's all of your guys are in prison at one time or another. So when it's your turn to go to prison, you're going to know guys in prison. And they will have already paid off the crooked guards to make life cushy for them. And now you take up their role and you pay off the crooked guards who continue this operation. The stranger who gets arrested and convicted and goes to prison, who knows no one, who doesn't know how to pay off anybody, who doesn't even dare to try to pay off anybody, they're the people who do the tough time. When Henry got there, he was greeted by a bunch of cronies right there, right at the door. They then took him through the orientation period, and within 2 weeks, he was living in a dormitory setting outside the wall. Now, Lewisburg is a maximum security prison. A Warner Brothers wall is around the thing with these turrets and guys with guns. And there was Henry outside the wall in a dormitory setting, something like a Holiday Inn, with four wise guys in each room. He was in there with three other hoods. They had steaks. They had beer. They had wine. They had liquor. They had anisette after dinner. They had their own little coffee grinders. They had – it was an extraordinary thing. And the guards, who should have been reporting this, of course, didn't. I said, you mean every guard was on the take? He said, oh, no, just a few. I said, well, then how'd you get away with it? I mean, were they the only ones? No, he said, you know, he said, if you pay a couple of guards and they take the money, the ones that don't take money, there are guards who will never take a penny from you. But you know what? He said, they won't report on the ones who do. And so they allow it to go on. It cost him, he said, when he was in prison, it cost him $500 a week in bribery alone.
And in order to make that money, he started selling drugs in prison.
You got it. Started selling drugs in prison. He started bookmaking in prison. He started loan sharking in prison. He started doing everything he ever did.
How did he get the drugs in to sell them?
They were all smuggled into him by other organized crime people, including his wife smuggled drugs in for a while. She would put the drugs into a – she went out and got an oversized brassiere and hip boots or, you know, high knee boots, several sizes too large, and she began stuffing the drugs into those boots. The search when you go in for your visits are very cursory. There is no major thing. You go through the kind of metal detector that you have in the airport, but that's all they do.
My guest is journalist Nicholas Pileggi, and we're discussing the subject of his new book. It's called Wise Guy, Life in a Mafia Family. When he got out, he still was selling drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And that was still taboo in parts of organized crime.
It was in his crew, in his organized crime, the family he was associated with, namely the Paul Vario faction of the Lucchese family. Paul Vario just hated drugs, didn't want them anywhere around him, didn't want anyone dealing drugs near him. He knew, I don't know whether this was a moral issue or was ethical or was just business, but Henry told me that Paul Vario you were forbidden to deal in drugs if you were with him. And the reason Vario said was that drugs were corruptors. Drugs not only, he said, you wind up in drugs, you're going to wind up having a cop for a partner. There's so much corruption in the operation. You wind up with cops for partners, and I don't want to be near you. And so he felt they had enough going with gambling and with loan sharking and with racketeers of all kinds that he didn't need the drug money. He was doing very nicely, thank you. Unfortunately for Vario, the guys under him, the Henry Hills, the Anthony Stabiles, the Angelo Seppis, those guys, they weren't doing as well as Paul Vario. They weren't doing as well as their superiors. And so for them, the extra money and they could get from drugs was extraordinary. And they went into drugs. And they kept it. They had to hide not only from the cops, but they had to hide from the organized crime bosses.
Did the bosses find out?
On occasion they did, and on occasion you'd find dead people.
It seems that after Henry Hill got out of prison, he got much more ambitious and took on some really bigger jobs than the jobs he'd taken on before. The point shaving scheme that he cooked up really shook college basketball. That was a pretty big story.
Oh, and it was.
One of the players was sentenced to 10 years?
Yes, one of them was.
How was this? Was this done a lot?
Well, I don't know whether it's done a lot. It was certainly done in his case. What happened was that, again, he was working off, he'd come out of prison. One of the men who was selling drugs for him in prison, or was smuggling the drugs into him at this point, lived in Pittsburgh. And the guy owed him $15,000, and Henry was going to take that money and go back into operation. When he got to the guy's house to pick up the money, now Henry isn't out of jail 24 hours, he's going to pick up his $15,000. The guy said, I don't have any money. All I've got is a garage full of grass, marijuana. Henry said, what am I going to do with that? He said, well, you know, take it. Take a couple of suitcases. Go get a suitcase. Get it. I'll give you all you want that'll be $15,000 worth. You'll be amazed. It'll be easy to get rid of. And he managed to unload the suitcase. He got something like $25,000. It was some special stuff. And he said, oh, boy, this is great. What am I knocking myself out for? And from then on, drugs became a major. First grass, then he went into chemicals, and then into cocaine, into heroin. Drugs became a major source of revenue for him. At the same time he was dealing the drugs, he's talking to this guy in Pittsburgh who was his supplier, and he said, you know, I know this guy, grew up with him. He used to be a ball player. And in fact, now he's a ball player at Boston College, you know, and he's a shrewd guy. And he said, well, maybe we can reach him. And there was a meeting, And Henry said, listen, I'm a sports fan, you're a sports fan, you're a college guy, rah, rah, rah. Look, I'm not asking you to throw a game. That's the last thing. I don't believe in that. But you don't have to win by so much. I mean, we got a point spread of 6. You win. You don't win by 6. That way I can bet the game, and I win, and you win the game because you win the game. You just don't win by so much, and I will bet on the number. And he managed, according to the federal court, where trials took place and people were convicted, to convince one of the players, and then that player convinced a couple of other players to shave points. And the point-shaving scandal at Boston College was a result of that. But here you see Henry just casually getting involved in a point-shaving scandal in a school. Ed McDonald, who's the United States Task Force boss in New York, who actually went to Boston College and played on the Boston College team, said Henry is the kind of guy, he hasn't rooted for anything but a point spread in his whole life. That's what he roots for.
And then the other really big heist he did was he was one of the people behind the Lufthansa heist, in which they got $5
million, was it? $5.8 million in cash, not a penny ever recovered, the largest successful cash robbery in American history.
And this was through getting the cargo from a plane.
Again, it was one of these cargo handlers out at Lufthansa who owed a bookmaker who worked for Henry Hill about $80,000 from debts. This is a poor cargo handler who had a junky habit as a gambler. He used to bet $500 on a game on a $300 a week salary check. And he, to get the wise guys off his back, to get that debt absolved, he knew about this money being transported to this country from Europe, and he told them about it. They went and they held the place up, and they got it.
That's where things started falling apart for him.
It did. It was so much money. It was such an unbelievable amount of money that instead of it freeing the group, and there were about a dozen men involved in that, when every one of the men began asking for his share, they began disappearing, or they would wind up dead. And the other guys were never sure why they were dead. You don't know, because everybody's in so many other things. And if one guy died, the rumor would get around, well, you know, it was a dirty drug deal. He had a drug deal in Newark that really went down bad, and they had to whack him, and he's whacked. Nobody knew why everybody was disappearing. Nobody wanted to relate it to the fact that we were getting murdered whenever we asked for our money. Henry knew. Henry said, I sensed it. I knew it. I knew these guys. I knew Jimmy. I knew what they were up to. And I knew when you ask for your money, you're dead. And that's what happened. About 10 people, 10 of the participants, 10 of the guys who were involved intimately with that robbery, who actually went in with the guns and held the place up, were all murdered. Henry was one of the last not to be murdered. And when he was arrested in the drug case, he realized his days on the street were over. Even if Henry didn't talk, you remember he was convicted of 10 years, never talked, never did anything. Even if he didn't talk, they were going to kill him because he might have talked. And that was it for Henry, and that's when he turned as a government witness.
Part of why he wanted to have this book written is so that he could, through a percentage of the royalties, get enough money to pay his lawyer. Have you ever thought that maybe he really embellished his life a lot so that he could
help you do a bestseller? Yeah, well, no. That was one of my first thoughts when I had to deal with him. But what the book is, it's while it's got Henry's story, everything he's told me, he was also telling the FBI at the same time. He was being debriefed for all of these cases at the same time. These cases went to trial. He testified in these cases. In these cases, if he would have lied in any one of these cases, he would have committed perjury. The entire agreement with the United States government would be null and void. He would go back to as a convict, and he would have been dead.
He's in the Federal Witness Protection Program now. And do you have any idea what kind of house he has, what kind of job he has or salary that he lives on?
Where he now lives, according to the Justice Department, this is the best I can get, is he lives in a house that's worth about $150,000. I have talked to him about, you know, it's a colonial, nice little colonial house. He's happy with it. He lives in a neighborhood that's crime-free. He's able to tell me that. He said that his kids are going off to school. They're healthy, nice kids. And he's living a marginally normal life. What he's doing and how he's acting and whether he's still a wise guy wherever he is, I don't know. If he gets arrested and falls into his old ways, he's in severe trouble.
It's funny. He told you that he really misses the life and he just feels like a schnook. You know, he's just living like any old schnook now.
What he's saying to us is that I'm living like you. That's what he's saying, and he's calling me a schnook, and he's calling you a schnook. He's calling everyone who lives a decent, honest, hardworking life, a schnook. But that's his mentality, and that's what he was twisted at 11, and he's twisted his whole life. And that's what these guys are. They're all a little, there's something missing up there. All of the wires didn't connect.
I love something you said to me before. You said that when you heard him talk about his life in organized crime, it sounded like the Cramdons. It sounded like the Honeymooners more than it sounded like the Godfather.
Yes, that is what it is. And it turns out even the bosses on his level, and his immediate bosses, and even the big bosses, they are not these totally sophisticated Robert Duvall, Al Pacino, brilliant people. They are really working class people for the most part, with very little education, very aggressive, very highly charged, and he's sort of like a lot of the guys around them reminded me of Ralph Cramden and Ed Norton on The Honeymooners. I mean, that's who they are. They buffalo people, and they have all kinds of schemes that don't work, and sometimes they work, but they're also violent, and they're also very dangerous.
You've mentioned a few times that the mafia movies that are so popular are really nothing like what organized crime really is like. What are some of the other differences between the way it's usually portrayed in films you've actually seen it?
There's a romance about the real world. There's a notion that there is this code of honor among a lot of them. It's not that I don't see too much of that. There's also the notion of they're going to take care of the wives when the husbands go to jail. Well, Karen didn't find that to be true, nor did the other wives. When your husband goes to jail, you're prey. A lot of the guys who were friends and pals started going around. They put the arm on the wives. They try to shake the wives down. Karen had a restaurant. Henry had a restaurant just before he went away for 10 years, and she sold all of the fixtures and sold all of the goods. And one of the wise guys, a partner of Henry's, said, "I'll take care of it. And I'll sell it for you. I can get good money for you." So she gave it to him. He did it. He never gave her the money. He refused. When she went to somebody who had worked for Henry and said, "Listen, we're in trouble. We helped you a lot. Henry took care of you for many, many years. I'm going to need some money to get me through this time." And he said, "You need money? Why don't you take your kids and go to the police station? They'll put you on welfare." That's the way they treated the women who were victimized in this situation. So that's a long way from The Godfather. That's a long way from Marlon Brando and his postulating.
That was Nicholas Pileggi, author of the book Wise Guy, Life in a Mafia Family, published by Simon & Schuster. Pileggi is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.